You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is the 8th of September, 2021. The first issue that's come up is I've received several emails about the Nominalism book, which is my top priority as of right now. A few months ago, I think the beginning of the summer, is going to be done somewhere between the 1st of November and the end of the year, and I'm still planning on that timetable. I said it in public because if I don't say it in public, I won't do it. It's a topic that is slowly beginning to be brought up by others, hearing it from me, and then doing their own work on it. Of course, in my case, this is from a patristic point of view. The Church Fathers as philosophers, not just theologians, or the relationship between theology and metaphysics. So that's what makes it even more unique. And so people have been asking about that. I'm really hoping for somewhere November, early December. Publishers are another matter. I'm still weighing those options. The second issue is the China book, which kind of came up suddenly, and the Afghanistan has taken over the news, which is unfortunate, but China will be back in it soon enough. And like all of these cases, the news is run by labels, myth and rumor, from people who have no right to be reporting on anything, let alone something as difficult and as critical as these foreign policy disasters. In the Chinese case, American ignorance could lead to a war that the U.S. couldn't hope to win. Five Americas couldn't hope to win against China and its many allies. And even if somehow it were able to win by some deceit, it would be such a bloody victory that it wouldn't be worth anything. Pyrrhic victory. Thirdly, of course, as always, my donors have been very generous. I turn 50 in a month, so I'm sure the presents are going to be rolling in. The more expensive, the better, of course. But I appreciate your support in every respect. And now, finally, the title of tonight's talk, today's talk, is from a paper I did back in 2019. I could have sworn I did a broadcast on this on Radio Albion, but I guess I haven't. It's called State Secrets, Britain's Misrepresentation of the Falklands War. This is probably the first political event that I have any real memory of. So I was 11, roughly, just turning 11, when this happened. I remember it on the cover. I think it was on the cover of Time. And I didn't understand by any means what was going on. My father was a big fan of Margaret Thatcher and always sung her praises, especially when it came to sending a flotilla across the planet. But I do have a few points to bring up concerning that war. And some of the problems with the official narrative. So, the background I think most of you know. In the late spring of 1982, the UK and Argentina went to war over the very sparsely populated Falkland Islands. That archipelago is claimed by Argentina, but is presently under British sovereignty. At the time, Argentina possessed a first-rate military. Now, Americans, I was 11, I could be forgiven, but people much more experienced than me actually believed that Argentina is a third-world country, mostly because they speak Spanish and they live far away. Argentina is a European nation with a, at the time anyway, a first-world economy, and so, if anything, the odds should have been in favor of Argentina. And of course, the argument couldn't be clearer here. Argentina won. Why then did they surrender and surrender so quickly? So, on paper, Great Britain was soundly defeated in that war. But the Argentinians, or Argentines as the British would say, were the ones who gave up. But I have, and again I have machine translated Spanish here, the British, in the words of its own commanders, were a week or two at most away from being completely exhausted. Like in most wars, the English, like the Americans, lie about their casualties, of course always far higher than the official numbers. But Argentina's showing was very impressive. And the question is, why did they give up? And why did the press refer to this as a British victory? And why early, I mean, the ignorance I can understand, early on, it was considered a mismatch, Argentina has no chance, as if they're going up against, you know, Morocco. The argument that I formulated is that the military government in Argentina cut a deal. It both ended the sanctions placed on the country, and importantly, avoided any future prosecution, the so-called genocide trial that the U.S. through the ICC, the International Criminal Court, were going to impose on the anti-communist military governments in Latin America. Many of you know I have a book on the topic, so-called military dictators of Latin America during the Cold War, and their actual record and what they actually believed, which very few people even bother to ask. So the military dictator at the time in Argentina and the commander of the Falkland Islands garrison were acquitted of these charges. Bogus though they were, was brought a short time later. However, a large number of their associates were convicted. And no one has ever asked this question before. Now, so far as who should actually own these islands, I take a neutral position. They're part of the same landmass as Argentina, but the population is about 100% British, and they intend to stay that way. Few remember or realize that the Soviet Union did not consider this an anti-colonial war because the population was fully English-speaking and were very patriotic. Kind of like, you know, certain Englishmen in Northern Ireland. But beyond that, the purpose of the war was to permit the mass exploitation of the region, especially by British oil and mining firms. At the time, 1982, at a time of the economic collapse of the UK, or near economic collapse. It's also not accidental. This was brought up at the time. The British military was facing massive cuts just a few weeks before the shooting began. The total decimation of its navy was on the table. And of course, when you had the Americans shouldering the burden of defense throughout Europe, European countries really didn't have the incentive to put together impressive militaries. Now, the Falklands is something that most people have minimal knowledge of. It's a very obscure part of the world. But they're uninhabited until 1764. The French established Port Louis, and then 2 years later, the British showed up and established Port Egmont. Founded on Saunders Island. The same year, then the French gave control over to these, to Spain. Then when the Spanish discovered the Egmont settlement, there was a brief conflict, and then the Spanish eventually gave the islands over to Britain in 1771. It doesn't mean that the two communities didn't coexist. Britain eventually withdrew in 1774. The Spanish then took over entirely. Only after the victory against Napoleon did Britain then reclaim the islands again, and by 1812 the Spanish were gone. And you really didn't have any permanent residence there. There wasn't an obvious economic reason to hold on to them. No one really cared about them. Now, like most of Latin America, Argentina fought for its independence. In the second decade of the 19th century. By 1823, Argentina permitted a, I guess they call him a German-born adventurer, Louis Vernet, to settle there. Argentina then named him ruler of the islands in 1829, although the British, for some reason, were angry at this, despite the fact that the Port Egmont camp had been abandoned. No Englishmen remained on the islands. Vernet captured three American vessels. They were the Breakwater, the Superior, and the Harriet, and arrested the crews. The charge was violating Argentinian laws. They were hunting seals, which was one of the few economic activities of the island at the time. Argentina, it used to be called the United Provinces, had granted Vernet full monopoly of seal hunting and total freedom for taxation, if he could make the settlement work. Very few people can handle the weather down there. But his act, despite having a certain legal right to do this, the U.S. then sent a warship, the USS Lexington, to attack Vernet and destroy his government there. You had a population of 45 at the time. All 45 were taken from their homes and sent to Uruguay. Now, the American cover story at the time was that Vernet's men were pirates, but they were let go without any charges once they were brought far away. It was a scam to bring the British back, which occurred in 1832. From there on, Argentina protested the British occupation. But it wasn't until 1840, until the islands became a crown colony, and Scottish settlers built a thriving community there. And that's the same one that's there today. When the sheep and sheep wool were introduced to the islands, only when that happened did you start seeing any money made. And the Falkland Islands Company was a state-chartered monopoly. Then, so by 1881, the islands became independent, financially independent. They even had their own currency. So the Falkland Islands Company, for 100 years, ran the country as a government over a small handful of residents. That became quite prosperous over time. But that doesn't mean tensions ever went away. Though I'm skipping over quite a bit of history here. One of the first people to make a big deal out of this was Juan Perón. If you have my book on Latin America, Latin American Military Leaders, I have a whole section on him. He was a full national socialist in every sense of that term. And he consistently brought up the sovereignty issue there. So in 1965, the United Nations passed Resolution 2065, calling on both countries to come to a peaceful settlement. But in the 60s, in 66 or 68, Britain did consider transferring control to Argentina, but the British living there were vehemently opposed to this. And the islanders did have a strong lobby in London. They wanted to maintain themselves as British as they humanly possibly could. But then the 70s, the British economy spun out of control. Again, London wanted to vacate the islands. Today, we have a population maybe of 2,200, 2,500. But it does have one of the highest per capita incomes on the planet. It's well over 50,000. So, because the population is 100% British, this is not really a matter of decolonization. It's not the issue. So, Argentina has to make the dispute a matter of territory rather than people. That's why even the Soviets had such a problem knowing where to land on this. Because of the fact that it's clearly not a colony. It has to be a colony. It has to be a foreign population lorded over by a distant capital. There has to be two ethnic groups involved, and that's clearly not the case here. So, it seems today that not a whole lot of people are going to deny that was Margaret Thatcher and NATO deliberately provoked this war. Thatcher was in a very unenviable position at the time. You had an employment rate, the official unemployment rate was 23%. It was much higher than that, of course. You had a massive social crisis. You had mass protests. You had mass bankruptcy. And, of course, at the time, Thatcher was on the verge of resignation. Thatcher took over. Inflation was about 30%. You had strikes everywhere. You had mass unemployment. You had rioting all over Britain, in Liverpool and certain districts of London, all recently deindustrialized, 80-81. But even as late as 85, unemployment remained very high, and rioting continued in London. And the worst form of humiliation I can imagine, the former ruler of the world had to borrow money and accept the structural adjustment from the World Bank and the IMF. It was Britain, not Argentina, that was headed to third world status at the time. Now, it's common for the ignorant, the propagandists, to make the claim that the Argentinian military government invaded the islands as a way to gain popular support. Of course, this isn't true. In 1976, the military seized power in that country and finally was able to crush the terrorist groups that functioned there. There's an array of communists and other guerrilla organizations, all armed and supplied from abroad. The Argentinian government was dealing with throughout the 60s and 70s. The Argentine Liberation Front, which is a Marxist-Leninist group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces for the Homeland, which is a little different, the People's Revolutionary Party, which was Leninist, the People's Guerrilla Army, which was pro-Cuban, and those are just the major ones. You had even left Peronists in the jungles too, despite Juan Perón's own national socialism. These groups were inactive by the 1960s, but they really became a part of the Leninist factions, making the Leninist movement the strongest there. As always, civilian government had no idea what to do, and faced with these threats, the military had no choice but to take over. But the ferocity of their response to the communists stems from the Bosch assassination attempt on General Jorge Videla. The attempt, though, showed a level of professionalism that proved foreign intelligence was involved. The military government finally put an end to this. The coup was fully justified and very successful. The ignorant also claimed that the invasion was a way for the military to distract from problems at home, which is ironic. The leader at the time was General Leopoldo Galtieri, who actually sought a peaceful resolution with Alexander Haig, the U.S. negotiator. The Argentine military was very well behaved in their invasion. No Englishmen were abused. All POWs were well treated. It was not Argentina that was trying to distract from something. It was the U.K. Budget cuts were deeply affecting the British military, especially the Navy. The Hermes, the aircraft carrier, was going to be scrapped. The Invincible was going to be sold to Australia. The huge ships, the Fearless and the Intrepid, the assault ships, were going to be dropped, eliminated, as well as a huge number of frigates and destroyers, which meant that the Royal Navy was going to be a shadow of its former self. The IMF was demanding massive structural reforms in the budget. The British military was saved by the Falklands conflict, at least for a short time. The official view was that a low-intensity war was necessary to restore the prestige of the government, to strengthen Thatcher, to avoid cuts in the Royal Navy, and to recover the initiative in the South Atlantic. The escalation of tensions with Argentina since 76 and the drastic end of the diplomatic negotiations show a far more sinister agenda here. This is just one example of some of the nonsense that's spoken of here. Nikola Budinovich, who is, trust me, very American, he wrote an article in the War History Online, and it's a very, very bad piece. Let me give just one example of some of the silliness here. He says, "The campaign was designed and executed in the midst of devastating economic stagnation in Argentina, which provoked civil unrest, to divert the civilian attention to the fall of living standards. With an inflation climb to 600%, military government did what they do best, mobilize the population towards general nationalistic sentiment, for the islands several hundred kilometers from the Argentinian coast that were under British colonial rule. And it's typical of guys like this. This is what, you know, amateur historians do best. Make sweeping generalizations, use words they don't know the definitions of, and make some of the most ridiculous arguments, even words like colonial, even though it doesn't apply here, trying to sound intelligent. Well, mobilization isn't what military governments do. It's a wild assumption with no evidence whatsoever. Armies come to power because the civilian administration fails. They fail to come to terms with social chaos. The army inherited these economic problems. Whenever someone bases an argument entirely on the belief that they know the inner workings of the mind, or that the inner workings of the mind are knowable, is very bad. Usually it covers over a terrible argument. The author even says that this is the Argentinian point of view of the war. And rather than that, he gives the precise establishmentarian British view that a single exception to this, and no sense of irony whatsoever. He says this. He says, before the invasion took place, the Argentinian junta helped CIA suppress the communist elements in Nicaragua by funding the Nicaraguan counter-rebels, or the Contras. This is why the Argentinians had reason to believe that the U.S. would keep a neutral stance if an invasion was to take place. See, these are arguments that these armchair historians think actually works. It's an awful argument, because it assumes the U.S. would abandon its closest ally. In fact, the army was convinced that the Americans would back the British. Turns out it was the Soviets and the Cubans who supported Argentina and its vehemently anti-communist military government. The other reason the argument's stupid is that, as I've already said, Argentina didn't just discover this issue when the economy went south. And the irony, of course, is that it was England that was worried about this. Now, 1983, they published a Falkland Island Review, a report of a committee of privy councillors. And they made it clear that the resurrection of national interest in the Falklands began in the early 60s from Argentina, which put an end to this silly argument that the military sought to use this war to boost its popularity. It's how American journalists really think about things. It's intellectually lazy, simple-minded, and hackneyed. The author doesn't seem to realize that Argentina was also at war with Chile at the time in the Beagle Channel conflict. So another war was definitely not in its interest. Again, the amateurs, Budanovich, assume that Argentina is a third world country. He doesn't seem to know that the country's military was a match for Britain, especially at such a distance. Its weakness, however, was its dependence on Europe for military hardware, and they were vulnerable to sanctions from the USA. Chile at the time was pro-British and assisted their war effort. That also meant that a large number of the best-trained Argentinian infantry had to guard the border during the war. And yet, still, Argentina inflicted crippling losses on the British that few people know ever happened. Now, this is a broader point here. The casualties of the Falklands War, by the way, are officially a state secret. The UK will not reveal them until 2072. That generally means they're hiding something. The task force, as they called it, the British task force, most of it, in fact, that was sent to reclaim the islands was destroyed or severely damaged. On May 1st, four Harriers were destroyed near Puerto Argentina. The next 2 days, four more Harriers were shot down, and they sunk the HMS Sheffield. The aircraft carrier Hermes was badly damaged by the, to say the least, the feared Exocet missile, which is made by the French. On May 6th, two Harriers were destroyed north of Soledad Island. On the 12th, the HMS Glasgow was knocked out, and the HMS Brilliant also damaged, severely damaged. By the 18th, 22 helicopters had been destroyed by Argentine forces. The Harriers, keep in mind, were developed by the American Marine Corps. This is a jet that can land like a helicopter. Now, they also had British were using two French-made, the Gazelles. On the 21st, two of them were shot down over San Carlos, despite being a French aircraft. The UK used many of them. Immediately after that, the HMS Ardent was sunk, the HMS Argonaut, and the Antrim, all knocked out of the war right afterwards. Then the HMS Broadsword was damaged, with another three Sea Harriers destroyed. Another was shot down on the 22nd, then making matters worse, on the 23rd, the HMS Antelope was sunk. The next day, HMS Sir Lancelot, Sir Galahad, Sir Belvedere, and the Fearless were badly damaged by Argentine forces. In the case of the Fearless, you had a much larger number of dead, which were not reported in the press. It had a crew of over 500 and carried about 300 soldiers to disembark in San Carlos. The 25th, three more Harriers were shot down. And to the shock of everyone, the HMS Coventry and the HMS Atlantic Conveyor were sunk. Afterward, dozens of helicopters were shot down, and on the 30th, the light Invincible aircraft carrier suffered extensive damage. The first week of June, the Tristram, the Sir Galahad, were sunk. The HMS Avenger was knocked out, as was the HMS Plymouth, hit by five Argentinian missiles. So on the British side, a grand total of 154 aircraft were lost, which means that of the 77 Harriers deployed, 46 were destroyed or damaged. They had 171 helicopters, 108 were damaged or destroyed. This does not sound like a crushing British victory. The British continue to claim that they only lost 277 men, which is a bald-faced lie, and they're aware of it. Now, most countries lie about their casualties. This is old news. The U.S. is one of the worst offenders in that regard. But the British infantry lost at least 1,090 men. And in my paper, I have all of the citations for this. I usually in Spanish. But it's probably too low. Now, the Argentinian government at the time said that only English soldiers were counted. Those with Indian or Chinese names weren't included. So you had many Chinese from Hong Kong involved in the flotilla as ship crews. Those wounded who died later were not counted as KIA. The U.S. does the same thing. And there's a reason the real casualty rate is an official state secret. Now, I have a full list here of the sunk or severely damaged British ships. And I've been through many of them. One was an accident, the Oberlin-class submarine, the Onyx. The Invincible light aircraft carrier. You had a whole bunch of frigates, like the Broadsword, the Plymouth. Logistic ships, that was the Sir Lancelot. The Hermes, I mentioned, the lightweight aircraft carrier. The destroyer, the Type 42 destroyer, the Exeter. The assault ship, the Fearless, as I mentioned. Support class, RFA Tidepool. I've been through, actually a few of their logistic ships were destroyed. And the Sheffield and the Coventry were both destroyers, Type 42. It was a crushing blow to the British Navy. And, of course, you had the landing barges. A whole bunch of them were sunk or damaged. They don't have names. And all of this happened in a space of roughly 80 days. Argentina lost one huge battleship, their central, the ARA General Belgrano, which was a pride of the Argentinian Navy. 323 sailors were killed. But the British did help and rescue about 700 men. Which means that about half the total deaths of Argentina's military forces come from this one incident. Now, for those who studied the issue, the British declared an exclusion zone around the islands of roughly, for an American, about 200 miles in circumference. And they warned that any enemy ship in the zone will be sunk. Now, Margaret Thatcher admitted in May of 1983 in BBC One that the Belgrano was not in the exclusion zone and that the British, allegedly in April, changed the size of the zone such that, despite the ship sailing away from the islands, remained a threat to the UK. It's been recently revealed, though, that the offensive orders to the Belgrano were canceled before its sinking due to the British cessation of airstrikes against Puerto Argentino and the Pedera del Ganso. So whether on purpose or not, I'm not saying that, the ship was definitely sunk unnecessarily. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Once the Argentinian military government fell, the liberal globalist government, of course, immediately took over, or came, took over later. And they made the claim that the sinking of their own ship was legitimate under the laws of war. Now, I don't know of any government that justifies the killing of its own men, especially a ship like the Belgrano. No government will justify the killing of its own men unless there's money at stake. Even the captain claimed it. But he says he was misquoted over it. But hanging over them were the so-called human rights trials for all members of the Argentinian armed forces at the time. Now, Kirchner, the president, rejected all these self-effacing comments. Argentinian military, which was totally dependent on Western sources of funding and fearful of this kind of prosecution, justified the killing of its own men in this particular ship. Remember, at the same time, Argentinian economy is being smothered through sanctions. When you have a continent as dependent on the U.S. like Latin America, sanctions are deadly. Banks were not doing business. Trade was strangled. This so-called victory for the British exists largely thanks to the help that Britain received from the U.S., other members of NATO, including also a non-member like Chile. All of Europe and the U.S., except Ireland and Italy, place severe sanctions on Argentina. Now, I have a series of quotes here. I took these from Spanish sources, laprensa.com.ar. Here's from a few significant leaders of the task force. The supreme commander of the task force was Admiral John Forster Woodward. And he said this: "I seriously considered calling home to say that we had lost. The situation seemed to indicate we would soon be out of play. At some point, we must start thinking about ending everything." He said later, he said, "If the Argentines had not given up on June 14th, we would have failed like June 21st, a week later. We were exhausted. The ships were exhausted. The engineering systems were exhausted. The weapons were exhausted. We were exhausted, like them. But they sold out first, the opposition less badly." I like how he used the phrase, "sold out." Brigadier Julian Thompson, commander of the 3rd Commando Brigade, said, "From the very beginning, I never had the slightest doubt that the Argentines were going to fight. They were only 600 kilometers away from their homes. They'd been there 5 or 6 weeks. They had the opportunity to gather the right amount of troops and supplies. If I had acted better together, I'm completely convinced that they could have won." General Chandler of the 2nd Paratroopers said, "I think the Argentinian Regiment 7 has a lot to be proud of. Mount Longdon was a very close battle, and many regiments would have disintegrated after a catastrophe. However, Regiment 7 did not, and 2 nights later, despite being subjected to the most intense artillery bombardment of the war, fought bravely. They also mounted a counterattack, one of the most difficult operations of the war." Now, Major General Jeremy Moore, who was the commander-in-chief of all British ground forces in the Falklands, said this: "The officers and commanders on the ground acted very well. Good, very good artillery, and good also the positions of machine guns, determined to stay till the resistance is completely exhausted. Such is so in some cases. The Argentine soldiers had to be practically torn from their posts. There were some who clung like an oyster to their shell." General Moore says, "However, despite the success, the progress towards Puerto Argentina had not been easy. Each attack, our trip with well-armed and entrenched Argentine troops, in some cases, our soldiers had to remain stuck in the ground due to mortars and the bullets fired by enemy elite shooters." Admiral, Harry Train, who was the commander of the U.S. Atlantic Fleet in 1986, said, and he's talking to Argentinians, he said, "I think you could have won at Puerto del Ganso. If anything had been done to stop the British advance, the British would have lost because the fleet had exhausted their support capacity. They had exhausted their anti-submarine weapons. They used up their ammunition from the cannons and began to suffer mechanical failures." The commander of the 5th British Infantry Brigade, General Anthony Wilson, said, "There is no doubt that the men who opposed us were tenacious and competent soldiers, and many died in their positions. We lost many men." Admiral Woodward again, He said, frankly, the Argentinians would have enough to blow us down. Who was winning at the time? We were certainly not. And he said that a week after landing in San Carlos, in which his fleet suffered severe damage. Woodward again. We were already at the limit of our capacities, with only three ships without major defects, which at the time were the Hermes, the Yarmouth, and the Exeter. Of the force of destroyers and frigates, 45% is reduced to zero capacity to operate. The Sea Wolf of the Andromeda is disabled. All the systems of the Brilliant suffer from a great variety of defects. The Broadsword, with a system and a half of weapons, but one with propulsion axes, and practically permanent damage. None of the Type 21 is fit. The Avenger is broken. The Arrow is damaged and has one of the Olympus turbines unused, and much more. Everything is falling apart. Now again, he wrote that right in the middle of the action. There's an English sailor who died on the Glamorgan, D. Tinker. One of his letters he wrote, it's very easy to understand how the war has been unleashed. Mrs. Thatcher imagined that it was Churchill challenging Hitler, and the Navy recommended a quick war before winter came. The Navy chiefs also wanted a fleet to surrender to the maximum to obtain the greatest publicity to avoid naval reduction. What has happened? In the latter case, victory or defeat would have given the same result, publicity and popular support, whether congratulations or at least understanding. Finally, the declaration of the sinking of the ship, General Belgrano, which is Dalyell, who was an opponent to Thatcher. And he said, and the truth is that the threat was not, and he's talking about the Belgrano. The truth is that the threat was not the old ship, but the peace proposal, since it would have deprived Mrs. Thatcher of a military victory, the objective of the Falklands War in the first place. It was about internal British politics, the foreign interests, and the inhabitants of the Falklands. Now, I'm not going to get involved in the debates over the Belgrano. That's been going back and forth for a long time. But Dalyell may have a point here. The biggest debate over the war was the sinking of that ship. Now, the quotes that I listed here speak to my point. The British had lost. They lost a ridiculous number of ships and Harriers and helicopters. They were running out of ammunition. And because it's so far from the home island, it was such a, you know, it was very difficult to resupply. So all of these quotes now, except for the one, are all from the British High Command. And there are many others. They put a great degree of suspicion on the Argentinian surrender. They were winning. Now, while dependent on American trade, lots of countries in Latin America supported Argentina. Even those who would have been hostile otherwise. Peru contributed a squad of 10 Mirage fighters, a French made. They were all dispatched from Peru to Argentina in April of 82. In Venezuela, the government of Luis Campins decided to contribute military supplies. The head of the Argentine Air Force, General Romulo Enriquez, said recently, 1999, that two Venezuelan Air Force planes clandestinely arrived in Tucumán in 1982, in May. They were never used. Brazil was long at war with Argentina. They donated at least two light patrol planes to the Navy. And they ended up replacing two of the Neptunes that were taken out of service. And the small Dominican Republic publicly offered to send troops to support Argentina, but they couldn't land. Now, despite the nature of the Argentinian government at the time, Cuba was simply following Soviet orders. In 1976, Cuba decided to provide information from the KGB in London about the position of British forces. Now, this is 76. This is much later. Cuba offered two battalions of almost 6,000 men specialized in cold-weather combat, trained by the Soviets in Siberia. In addition to MiG-21 aircraft and the MiG-23B and Flogger H, which was specialized jet focused on anti-ship and submarine warfare, piloted by Cubans. None of these could land on Argentinian territory. Now, the USSR was pleased despite the anti-communist government. The Argentinians did support the Soviets during the American embargo over the Afghanistan issue. And both the Cubans, which they had decided even in the 70s, because again, this war was heating up in 1976, as I mentioned. The Soviets were providing the Argentine government with, they're using the Tu-95, the Bear aircraft from Angola, to monitor the British fleet. A Soviet nuclear submarine was also deployed in the conflict to track British ships. Even Gaddafi in Libya offered a huge array of high-tech missiles to Argentina. In Europe, there was only a few. Spain was the only European country to condemn the British attack. I mentioned the other two, Ireland and Italy. The technical specs of the English Harriers were sent to Argentina, since Spain uses the same model in their own navy. But this only underscores the fact that the UK was in serious trouble in 1982 in all respects. This was a disastrous campaign. So the question is obvious. Why in heaven's name did Argentina surrender? The military governor, General Mario Menendez, was not given an attack plan or even a defense plan. Nowhere in the world would a garrison of about 8,000 very well-equipped men, who hadn't even begun to fight, offer surrender terms after losing not even 10% of their manpower. The military regulations and militaries throughout the world accepts the idea that a force surrenders with honor only after having run out of ammunition and suffered an 80% casualty rate. That's the standard for militaries around the world. Riots erupted in Argentina. The Western press said it was because they were angry at the military government because they lost. No, they were very angry because it surrendered under such favorable conditions. I have a full list of what was confiscated after the Argentinian surrender. These guys were far better equipped than the British were. Coast Guard patrol boats, the Falkland Islands, and which of course was renamed Bahia de Tigre, 11,000 rifles, about 4 million rounds of 7.62 ammunition, Skyguard FC plus radar with five of them, whole numerous radar stations, 14 helicopters, SAM 7, which the soldier lost, launched anti-aircraft missiles. You had guns and cannons from all over the place, with tons of ammunition, even an improvised Exocet launcher, which they had put together themselves. Several SAMs, the Roland and the Tiger Cats, 12, which is a Panhard 90mm vehicle, essentially an armored car. Heavy truck, meaning this is what the British confiscated. They'd only begun to fight this war. And they were well aware that Britain was on the brink of defeat, as its own officers admit. The surrender could only have happened through dishonesty. Now, on June 14th, the Argentinian commander, as I mentioned, General Menendez, spoke to President Galtieri. Galtieri reminded him of his duty. Remember, he's a military man himself. And then gave the morally permissible conditions for surrender. Total loss of ammunition, 80% casualty. The very fact that he had to lecture his commander in that respect means that he was aware that something was wrong. Menendez replied, apparently he said, "I can't ask my troops for more. After all what they've been through, we don't have the capacity to retreat to the heights. We don't have any room. We don't have the means. We don't have the support," is what he said to Galtieri, which is factually false. When the British contacted him, Menendez seemed suspiciously cooperative. He agreed to meet with the British High Command and deliver his men over. There was a private, Riz Milton, who was an Argentine conscript of British descent, who was present in the radio room as the orders were given, reported that shortly after the conversation, a shell fell into the backyard, and it knocked Menendez against the door, and it sprayed the room with splinters. That's when he made that statement. It's almost like he was just frightened at that point. In a 2015 story in the UK Independent, General Menendez said, as he's, ordering this, "I had not slept for 36 hours. I was so tired. but I made myself presentable, like a German general would. I thought, this is the end. I didn't argue, since I knew my troops couldn't give any more. Now that's when he was ready to give the surrender order, which doesn't make sense. That's not the bearing of a general. Now, talking about Admiral Woodward, the same article says, more somberly, Woodward reflected that had Menendez chosen to spin the land campaign another 10 days, that would have finished the British off, not him. So, it's hard to believe that the Argentinian high command didn't know this. They were aware of the damage they had inflicted on the British, the difficulty the UK had given its distance, bringing reinforcements in. Many countries were monitoring the situation for them anyway. They knew exactly what was going on. The only thing it could be, they negotiated an end to the sanctions in exchange for surrender. But that's not the only reason. General Menendez was imprisoned by his government upon returning to Argentina for his surrender and disobedience to orders. This is after the fall of Gutierrez, by the way, so it was not politically motivated. He surrendered having suffered only light losses with a huge amount of equipment at his disposal. He was winning. Afterwards, he was rearrested for crimes against humanity, which, by the way, did not stick. Now, after the surrender, despite Galtieri's command that he not, the military government fell. Through the IMF, the U.S. took over the country through their agent, Raul Alfonsín, who essentially was an errand boy for the IMF. Immediately after the military government fell, most, if not all, state-owned industries were sold to the Americans. As a lawyer, Alfonsín defended the communist guerrillas accused of killing civilians. The U.S. and NATO, as always, condemned any and all attacks on communist forces in Latin America, unless it was from a government that it could control, and the military governments were never governments they could control. Immediately, of course, American and European oil companies moved into the Falklands, and the Argentinian military, once a very formidable force, was slashed to the minimum. Somehow, the communist guerrilla movement was faded away. It faded away at a time of tremendous weakness for the military. And it's curious. It suggests that the U.S. were backing it the entire time. Alfonsín condemned the Argentinian Anti-Communist Alliance, but in exchange for this 82 surrender, Galtieri was acquitted of all crimes, as was Menendez. Suggesting, of course, that they cut a deal. Not that they had done anything wrong anyway. But just like attacking ISIS will get you in trouble, the Americans, attacking the communists, they will also get you in trouble. There were no human rights abuses during the Argentinian Civil War. It was a desperate government fighting off a leftist terror movement. In fact, any anti-communist action was considered ipso facto an abuse. These guerrilla groups did not wear uniforms. They didn't abide by the laws of war governing irregular forces. By definition, then, no wartime human rights abuse can possibly occur, because there was no inherent distinction between combatants and civilians. I've said it before. Under international law, any crimes become the fault of the rebels, not the state, when they don't distinguish themselves from civilians. As far as the U.S. was concerned, unless these generals hanged, no aid money would be forthcoming to Argentina. Only the two cooperative generals, Galtieri and Menendez, skated by. Therefore, it is very likely, almost certain, that the lifting of the sanctions and avoiding prosecution were the reasons Argentina surrendered. Not to mention, of course, the oil issue. The Argentinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said this not too long ago. Great Britain has transformed Las Malvinas Island into a key military base for the control of the South Atlantic, the interoceanic access projection into Antarctica, securing the exploitation of the natural resources of the South Atlantic that belong to the Argentinian people. Now, despite all the diplomatic bombast, what he's saying here, and what most of us know anyway, the British oil firms have announced plans to begin drilling into the sea, into the area. There are some who claim that maybe 60 million barrels of crude are under the waves. The islanders will receive less than 20% of that, making it very profitable for them, for companies. Since 2013, tensions have increased. Argentina says that anyone caught drilling for oil and gas in this area will spend 15 years in jail. There's two, as of a few years ago, the two British companies drilling are the Rockhopper Exploration and Premier Oil. So if any of those, anybody from those two companies step foot on Argentinian soil, they'll be immediately arrested. The government has sent threatening letters to investors in the London Stock Exchange, attempting to frighten prospective financiers and thus drive down the firm's value. So as bigger oil finds are exciting British investors, the Argentinian response is going to put a damper on their enthusiasm. So in 2015, Argentina filed suit against British oil interests and vowed to fight them at every turn, which of course frightened investors. Daniel Filmus, who's minister in Argentina for the Falklands, stated the following. I want to make it clear for the directors of these companies and for British public opinion that Argentina will use the full force of the law, both national and international, to prevent these countries from taking the riches which belong to 40 million Argentine citizens. Argentina has extradition treaties around the world, and we intend to use them. Now, the British, who at one time had an empire spanning the entire globe, had the audacity to say that this was international bullying. And as bully victims may do, begin increasing its military presence on the island. And I'm telling you that the war in the Falklands may not be over. In fact, maybe it's only just beginning. Now, I've made several points in this paper. The first point I made is that I'm not taking a position here. It is a British set of islands. Not by territory, but certainly by population. Those living there, as far as I know, are doing very well. They have very, very high incomes and are extremely proud to be British, which makes sense given how far away they are from Britain. It would be a crime to have another country take them over, despite Argentinian claims. The history of the islands is a very strange one. They've gone back and forth, several powers, since the 18th century. For the most part, they were considered pretty useless and very hard to defend. But today, of course, oil and gas have changed that. It's still a very difficult place to work. It's an objective fact, though, in the third place, that Britain lost the war, and they lost the war badly. I remember even as a kid, and I must have heard 1,000 times after that, whenever this comes up, that how dare the third world poor Argentinian military take on the mighty British? As if we're talking about Paraguay here, or Panama. Argentina is essentially a European country. It is a European country. You're more Indian, looking Latin Americans are up in Bolivia. Down south, we've got Chile and Argentina. These are first world people. And at the time, thanks to state-owned enterprises, they had a first world economy and certainly a first world military. Britain's disadvantage, of course, was that they were coming such a long distance. Thatcher was in a bad position in a million different ways. People forget that the World Bank and the IMF had taken over Britain for a while, placed it under receivership. You imagine, in just a generation, going from the icon of world power, for better or for worse, on the one hand, now coming under the receivership of the IMF. This is what globalism is. This is what liberalism can do. This is the power. All the anti-colonial forces around the world, all the armies, Germany, Hitler, World War I, World War II, Crimea, none of this can bring down Britain, but liberalism did. If everything that Britain had been through in its history, it becomes a minor power militarily only under liberal globalism. That's how powerful it is. And it will do it to anyone it touches. Now, talking about, you know, we can't make arguments based on the inner workings of the mind. They don't work in court. They don't work anywhere. Now, when you have something very obvious, when there's simply no other motivation, maybe it's acceptable. When the person that you're talking about or the country you're talking blatantly says this is why we're doing it, it's another matter. But how easy it was for people at the time and now to claim that the military government, which they claim is, you know, inherently bad, wanted to distract from a bad economy and take over the islands and start a war. Britain was in no position to abandon these islands. What would the Irish do? You can't simply let things go. No country can do that. Certainly not the British, who had let a lot go just for the previous 30, 40 years. To this day, people think Argentina is a third world country. Now, maybe it is now, thanks to liberal globalization, but certainly not at the time. You see the names of some of its politicians. They're not obviously Spanish ones. But liberalism brought it low as well. As I mentioned, after the war was over, the IMF came in and took over, and essentially the country was sold off to the Americans. People also forget the condition of Great Britain in the late 70s, early 80s. It looked like this former world ruler had been now reduced to, you know, riots and mass unemployment and mass, extremely high inflation, interest rates, to the point where it simply couldn't function on its own. Of course, we all know the London bankers had pocketed a huge amount of the surplus. I'm not obviously denying that. They're the ones who help create this. When you have labor unrest, mass unemployment, this is a completely different story. Liberalism has its home in Britain. They reap what they sow. Finally, and most importantly, the reason for Argentina's surrender. General Menendez's bizarre behavior. Any of these anti-communist military leaders in Latin America has been condemned by the U.S. My book on the topic, which is on Amazon, it's Formada Books, but the guys from Russia Insider, one of these books that they helped me put together and publish. Any anti-communist movement was condemned by the West. The U.S. did not support anti-communist military governments in Latin America. The exact opposite is true. I've dealt with this before. How they define support. You know, if they're not being invaded, therefore they're supported. There's almost no reliable information, especially in English, probably in Spanish, which unfortunately I don't speak, or Portuguese, about what these military governments were, what they believed in. That's what my book on the topic is about. I did not deal, however, with this topic in the book because it was a separate essay. Argentina went from first world to third world status in a few years because this loss permitted, out of fear, the military to allow itself to be slashed to the bone and its commanders put on trial for daring to fight the communists. It's very interesting that these Marxist-Leninist groups that had fought the army to a standstill all of a sudden disappear after the Falklands War. You would think that they would grow in strength and power. They were not getting support from the Soviet Union. But that would have easily changed once the war was over. They were being supported by the West. Why would Cuba and the USSR firmly support the anti-communist military government if that was the case? Not a whole lot has been done in English on the inner workings of these Marxist-Leninist groups. Very much like ISIS today. Now, ISIS is a very obvious case of Western support, Western-created organization, but they would have been able to make headway had they coalesced after the war was over in Argentina. They didn't. They faded away. So it seems that the military did two things. They negotiated a surrender for the sake of the sanctions coming to an end, on the one hand, on the other hand, to avoid prosecution for human rights abuse. Human rights abuses is, in the terms of the global agenda, is being part of a civil war. You're part of a civil war, you fight the communists or the leftists, you're by definition violating their ideology and therefore this nonsense human rights. They knew they were going to be railroaded, and the only way out was to admit, when you have a country accepting that the Belgrano had every reason to be, they know they had no reason to destroy it. That was a symbol of old Argentina, National Socialist Argentina. Sinking it, you have Margaret Thatcher saying that there was no good reason to do it. So the Argentinian government, after Galtieri's removal, the government afterwards saying that it was perfectly okay to kill Argentinian soldiers and sailors, Marines. No one does that unless there's a firm agenda behind it. Money, sanctions, avoiding prosecution. This nonsense that the U.S. supported anti-communist military leaders and juntas in Latin America is utter, complete nonsense. They were at war with them. In my book on the subject, I show where in Peru and a few other places, the military brought in American labor unions, the AFL-CIO, to assist them in the land program of giving land to peasants. Whenever this occurred, whenever the actual transition of land ownership was being done, all of a sudden the communists attacked it. They'd kill peasants all over the place rather than let them take land given to by the what ultimately amounts to a National Socialist military state. This happened all over Latin America. It doesn't help that the Catholics in Latin America fully supported the left, then and now. If you go back to my lecture on Romero in El Salvador, who was recently canonized by the Church of Rome, believe it or not, you'll get more detail as to how and why the Catholics and the Jesuits in particular down there supported every Marxist group without exception. I'm not just talking about the liberation theology either. I'm talking about the hierarchy as a whole. Not just the Jesuits weren't even from that. Not just that. Ordinary priests certainly didn't, but the hierarchs certainly did. The U.S. would destroy and condemn any attack on Marxist groups in Latin America without exception. You have a few exceptions. You had the entire establishment come out against the government in El Salvador in the 80s. The condemnation of the Contras, right so far as getting to the so-called Iran-Contra scandal. That's how obsessed the regime was in making sure that these groups were not supported. And even when the Sandinistas in Nicaragua fell, nothing of substance took their place. Liberal democracy, the Banana Republic, took over. The military, prior to these groups, actually lived, and I have a whole thing on Somoza, Batista. I've done a lecture on Batista not too long ago. These were military leaders who were doing what the communists were only promising to do and had no intention of doing. Anyway, that's the story of the Falklands War. It is a British possession. It should remain that way. But this is why wars are fought. And this is what happened. And this is why the Argentinian National Socialist military government was forced to surrender way back in 1982. Thank you for listening, everyone. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.